Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. Today we have a special edition of Research on Religion. Based on the success of our first simul podcast with Econ Talk a few weeks back, we are partnering with Samuel Wilson and his blog, YouVoluntary Exchange, to discuss religion and YouVoluntary Exchange. You can find a link to Samuel's blog over at our website. And if the term YouVoluntary Exchange sounds scary and unfamiliar to you, don't worry, as we cover the basic dimensions of that relatively new concept making the rounds in the world of economics. This is a free-flowing discussion where we examine to what extent religious choice is coercive or not, and we cover significant ground, ranging from cannibalism to Jonestown, and from the Bellamy brothers to virtue-preserving federalism, apostasy, and Catholic notions of subsidiarity. I should note that the audio has a slight echo in it because we recorded the interview in a large drainage pipe in Fairfax, Virginia. Well, not actually a drainage pipe, but a room that wasn't conducive to audio recording. That aside, I do think you'll find the conversation thought-provoking, so let's get right to it.
Welcome to the YouVoluntary Exchange podcast. I'm your host, Sam Wilson. Joining me today is Professor Anthony Gill of the University of Washington. Tony is a professor of political science over there on the Seattle campus. And as an interesting personal note, I got my undergraduate degree at the Tacoma campus from the Milgard School of Business. So he's a hometown pal of mine. Today we'll be discussing YouVoluntary Exchange and how it relates to religion. We'll talk a little bit about that organization and the role of coercion in religion, and let's see how things progress. That sounds good. I want to thank you for being for inviting me on the show today, and it's always a great opportunity to link and network podcasts, so this is really interesting. And when you approached me, you told me you wanted to do YouVoluntary Exchange and Religion. I'm still fuzzy on that whole concept of YouVoluntary Exchange, and I think a lot of my listeners are. It's a growing field of interest within a certain substrata of economics. So what is, if I want to talk about this today, what is YouVoluntary Exchange?
Well, that's an excellent question. I'm glad you asked. YouVoluntary Exchange is the brainchild of Duke University political science professor Mike Munger, who you may recognize from his numerous Econ Talk podcast appearances with the excellent Russ Roberts. In a nutshell, what Mike was worried about was the nature of people's relationship with market asymmetries. So the story that he likes to motivate the YouVoluntary Exchange with is really good. Several years ago, there was a hurricane that swept through North Carolina, and it knocked down a bunch of trees and power lines and stuff, and all of Raleigh was isolated. Well, a few local yahoos saw this as a market opportunity. They saw that the power was out in Raleigh, so they went and rented a truck and loaded up with ice, brought along a few axes and chainsaws and stuff to clear out the roads. And their idea was that we're going to haul this ice out to Raleigh and we are going to make some sweet cash. We'll buy it from our local stores for, I don't know, $1 a bag, and we'll get there and we'll sell it for $5 a bag. Think of, we're going to be rolling in it. We're going to be rich.
That's great, you guys.
That's a great profit opportunity there.
It is. It is a great profit opportunity. And think of all of the positive spillovers. You get a bunch of cleared roads so you don't have to wait for the North Carolina Highway Department to clear out for you. And people get ice. People who don't have ice get it. Well, anyway, so these guys show up with their ice truck, and then they start selling ice in the square in downtown Raleigh there. And wouldn't you know it, a big old line starts piling up. And people are there, you know, willing to spend, you know, five times the normal price so they can get ice so their food doesn't spoil.
I can imagine some of them were mad. They were feeling they were getting ripped off. Well, that's exactly what happened. Somebody apparently called the police, and the police showed up, and they said, what the hell do you think you're doing, guys? This is entirely inappropriate. You cannot sell this ice. This violates North Carolina price gouging statutes. We're going to have to confiscate your vehicle, and we're going to take your ice and dump it out all over the street so that nobody can use it. And that's exactly what they did. And the people who were standing in line waiting to buy ice with their own money that they could take home so their food wouldn't spoil, what do? They cheered.
Even though they were going to buy it for $5 a bag.
Even though they were going to be worse off if they weren't going to buy the ice, they were still happy that the police were there shutting these bad, bad price gougers down.
Well, that sounds like a kind of weird story. I can see why they would be mad, and I can see why they might cheer that that there's actually a law on price gouging and it was enforced, but none of them ended up with ice. So how does this relate to U Voluntary Exchange?
A U Voluntary Exchange is one that meets the following criteria. And one of them is going to be important to understanding the ice truck story. The other conditions are typical for any sort of voluntary exchange. So you need the conventional capacity for ownership. That means it's something that I own. I can't sell you the Brooklyn Bridge because I don't own it. You need to have conventional capacity to exchange, which is something that, well, it's fine for us to trade at any other time. So the counterexample to that would be for the German voluntary cannibalism case. Do you remember this?
No.
Armin Mavis?
No, not at all. I don't read very much on cannibalism.
there was a case several years back where a gentleman was soliciting volunteers to be cooked and eaten.
Hmm.
And a guy raised his hand and said, yes, I would like that. And they went through an entire process, vetting process, and it took a long time. There were plenty of options to opt out, and the guy said, yes, 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 please cook me and eat me. And he followed through with it. And eventually it was found that was an unconscionable contract.
Mm.
So it was void in the eyes of the law. This is not something that, this is not a transaction that people can make. Therefore, you're guilty of gross stuff. He originally was acquitted for something, and then he got convicted of some other charge. I don't recall the details.
Okay.
But the UCC, the Uniform Commercial Code, which is United States, the several states have rules over which things can and cannot be exchanged. So you can't buy and sell yellow cake uranium, you can't buy anything off a controlled substance list without authorization, so on and so forth. That's the conventional capacity to exchange.
Okay.
And the third one is the absence of ex post regret. That means that if I buy a lemon from you and I'm upset afterwards, that's not a valid exchange. So we have anti-lemon laws, we have rules about addictive substances.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, I can see where this goes to the addictive substances, where you have somebody, you know, selling you a bag of heroin really cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, well, that sounds like a good deal, but later on you regret the fact that it might have some biochemical reaction with you. Mm-hmm. And you're addicted to it, and so now you regret buying it at that first point. Now, that just seems to be largely informational problem, right? That you don't know about the addictive quality of it, or you don't know the condition of the car that you bought in it, that it is a lemon.
It could be an information asymmetry problem. It could also be an accidental regret problem. So you as the seller don't know that there's a problem. I as the buyer don't know that's a problem.
Mm.
There's a problem with what I'm buying. So there are instances of both moral hazard and adverse selection. So moral hazard is when information asymmetry is in the pocket of the seller. The adverse selection is when the information asymmetry is in the pocket of the buyer. And then, like I said, we have just markets, or we have instances where both parties come to a contract and they both find out after the contract's been signed that, oh man, this is bad, or something changed, something happened. The no ex post regret sort of pushes that off to the side for the purposes of strict voluntary exchange. There's more analysis in there in this point.
Well, I can see how this is going to become rather important for religion, because mm-hmm. as the absence of ex post regret has developed, there's both legal reasons that we restrict that. So the lemon law is that you can return a car after 90 days if it doesn't work. But also there's informal rules. So Nordstrom, for instance, allows you to return clothes after a month or two with no questions asked, or Costco does that as well. It's going to become interesting, I think, later with religion, is that if the ultimate product is salvation and you can't verify that until you're long after dead, there's not really a return exchange period. So I can see how this is going to be important.
Okay. Yeah.
So those are three of them. What else do we have in e-voluntary exchange?
So the next one is the absence of coercion. So if I hold a gun up to you and I say, here's your choice, your money or your life, that is that's not even voluntary. That's a coerced exchange.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be another quasi-important one for what we'll be talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The one that sort of Munger likes to concentrate on, and one we talk about a lot on the blog, is coercion by circumstance, which is defined as no BATNA disparity. Although it could be that, so I should explain what BATNA is. It's an acronym that stands for Best Alternative to a Negotiated Agreement. That means, what does failure to exchange apply for both sides? So if failure to exchange implies that I'm going to hell in the case of religion, or it means that I'm going to starve, or I'm not going to be able to board my windows in the event of a hurricane, or if it means that I'm just going to be in really bad shape. Or the recent one that came up was the West Virginia groundwater contamination case. So there was a price gouging suit brought against a gentleman who runs a convenience store in West Virginia, and the best alternative to a negotiated agreement for the residents when it comes to the sale of bottled water is they have to drink poison that's coming out of the tap.
And that's not a good option.
That's not a good option.
Yeah.
So he, for sensible economic reasons, raised the price of water in order to induce more bottled water to come to that region of West Virginia. And he had slapped for price gouging. And again, this offends people's moral sensibilities because of this BATNA disparity. If he doesn't sell one extra bottle of water to him, it's just, a few bucks worth of a lost sale. If he doesn't sell a bottle, if one of his customers doesn't buy that bottle of water, that means that his kid won't be able to drink healthy water that evening. That's a disparity.
And so you want to keep that cost as minimal as possible to make it a voluntary exchange.
Or as equitable as possible.
Okay.
So either there are sort of two ways where BATNA can offend. And the first way is where there's a big disparity, where one person doesn't have big downside risk and anyone does, or when the downside risks are just plain old severe.
Mm-hmm.
So if both the buyer and the seller are going to be in bad circumstances, you can think of labor in developing economies sort of fit the bill. So the Bangladeshi factory issue that happened a while back is an example of this.
That's when they chained the doors shut for the workers.
Yeah, and the place was in death trap, and it was all rusty and everything, and that's just plain old no good.
Okay. Right?
So that's desperation in BATNA, and there's also words about disparate BATNA. And the last one is something that will be familiar to any economist listening, and that's absence of negative externalities. So if you and I are exchanging something and a third party is going to be made worse off by nature of our exchange, then the exchange is no longer voluntary. Still may be good, still may be wise, but it doesn't fit the bill for voluntary.
Okay.
But that's voluntary exchange. It's a place to start when thinking about moral intuitions.
And I think that's a really interesting concept. I've been lured into this by listening to Mike Munger talk about it and reading some of his papers. And you contacted me and wanted to talk all about religion and how this plays into this. And for me, listening to voluntary exchange discussions, it's a nice sideshow for me, but I wasn't really connecting it to religion. But the more that you talked about it, the more that I started thinking about, there's something here to think about. So let's start talking about that.
Yeah. Well, one way that I think is reasonable to think about religion is that it's
pretty much a contract. Even in the Bible, the language is the covenant with God.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's a contract. You do this set of things. You live your life this particular way, and the reciprocation will be, you know, life in heaven,
mm-hmm.
eternal glory. I don't think the Bible actually uses the term heaven so much.
Anyway, salvation or something along that lines, right? Yeah, I understand. So there is that personal relationship, and this almost gets to Pascal's wager that if, you know, you believe in God, then you get X, Y, and Z. If you don't believe in God, then you don't get that kind of thing. Of course, if God does not exist, this is one of the complicating factors. There's a great deal of uncertainty whether God does exist or not exist. We are constantly debating in our philosophical things. So mm-hmm. I guess this complicates the you-voluntary exchange relationship a little bit, because you don't know if you actually have a exchange partner or not at that level of personal salvation.
At that level, no. But at the level, at the organizational level, we definitely do have an exchange. Membership in a church can also be interpreted as an exchange between the organization and the congregant.
And this is an important thing that you brought up when we were talking the other day, is that we think of religion, we think of personal beliefs a lot of times. But as we just talked about here, there is that uncertainty aspect to it. Is that, well, I can have a personal relationship with God, but, mm-hmm. you know, is God there? Many people do think they talk to God and that God gives them signs and things like that. But a lot of other people, including devout Christians, say, well, there's some doubt here. There's something that always exists. And so in order to alleviate that doubt, organizations have arisen that help to propagate, explain, and trade. I like to think of religious organizations as being a trade, and I love to couch it in terms of Adam Smith's notion of specialization and trade, mm-hmm. in that, you know, as a political science professor, I don't have time to, 24 hours in a day, to deal with all the theological issues that I do. I wouldn't have time for other things, raising my kids or doing work at the university or things like that. So we allow people to specialize, and that gives religion basically an organizational form, which then brings that into this you-voluntary exchange contract.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So the interesting sort of question to ask is how you-voluntary is church membership? And I don't know if there's necessarily a clear yes or no answer to it. I think it's kind of, it depends on what relationship the person has with their church leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it also depends on what the difference is between the ends of the parishioner and the ends of the organization are, whether or not those align well, and whether or not that, even in the event that they don't align,
mm-hmm.
is it necessarily a problem? So when we're doing analysis of firms, for example, in economics, we're always worried about this principal-agent problem. A firm is interested in maximizing its value. Normally, for publicly traded firms, we talk about maximizing stock price as an indicator of, yes, this business is producing value for the customer and for the people who are interested in it. It's reflected in the stock price. Or in the case of tech startups, it's reflected in their buyout price.
Mm-hmm.
You come up with some app and you want to eventually sell it to Apple or Microsoft or Google or whatever. So you make a really cool product that everyone wants, and you increase the probability and the price that you'll be bought out at. It's basically the same idea.
Okay. And so let me answer that in terms of churches then. And
yes.
Then we'll go to the side of the parishioner, the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of a church organization, and I'm one of these people who does look at churches as firms in an economy, making exchanges with individuals, consumers, or parishioners.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that language freaks people out, but you know, bear with us, folks, for a little bit here. But the goal of a religious organization can be many, much like a firm can, but what I have generally assumed and what many people who do the economics of religion assume is that churches try to not maximize profit, P-R-O-F-I-T, but profit, P-R-O-P-H-E-T, in that they want to spread the word of God, get as many people to believe the message that they have, get as many adherents. And so in terms of a very crass, market-oriented or economic way of saying this, the churches tend to be interested in market share more so than financial profit. Although one could argue, you know, there's always these cases in the news of, you know, mega churches ripping people off or something like that. They could be interested in financial profit, but I think first and foremost, the major goal that they have is trying to spread the word of God and get as many adherents as they can.
Well, I wouldn't be so quick to dismiss financial profit. I think in the case of religion, when it's operating at its finest, its Platonic ideal, if you will, there is still a notion of profit, but it's not in dollars and cents. Rather, it's in virtuous living.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So when we talk about profit in the marketplace, profit's actually just an accident. It's a spillover. It's a waste product. What really matters when people are going into the marketplace and buying and selling is that the customer is better off than she would be without making the transaction, and the seller is better off than she would be without making the transaction. But what really matters is the value that's delivered to the person who's making the purchase. If I go in and I buy a candy bar, mm-hmm. I'm richer in my life by one candy bar, by all the delicious sugar and fat and everything that's contained in that candy bar. Similarly, in religion, when I go and sit down and pray and do my, I'm actually not observance, so
that's hypothetically.
Hypothetically, if I went in I prayed and did my best, the spillover benefit would be I would lead a more virtuous life.
Mm-hmm.
And you can think of the benefit to society of that as being similar to financial profit. So it's generating this surplus value for all of us to enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, and I can understand that. You put the emphasis there on the consumer side, mm-hmm. and also the societal side, but I think from the producer side, the side of the firm that makes the candy bar or the side of the church that actually creates a forum such that a preacher can explain things much like we would at a university. You know, here's how economics works. Well, here's how the Bible works. Here's how the Old Testament works, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. They get gains from that trade as well, too, is that the more successful they are, the more people are willing to either contribute financially, they're more willing to volunteer their time, yeah. which is another form of profit to follow, and also to bring other people into the church, and that boosts the ability of that organization to find stuff. So I like this whole notion of a trade, of specialization that occurs in an economy, and that there's a trade between a religious organization and a parishioner, somebody who wants to believe, a congregant. And that's a nice way of framing the study of religion that I don't think a lot of people do. And so this is what this really does bring to the table. Let's bring it back to that voluntary exchange thing. Because here's the issue, right? There's a producer, a church, mm-hmm. that can facilitate this. Now, they could be giving you lemons, right? They could be selling you bad product, the snake oil, creatures mm-hmm. that you see these in movies and television, they're out throughout history, that they come through town, they wave their hands a lot, and people dump them a lot of money, but they were selling a lot of hoo-ha, and they knew they were selling a lot of hoo-ha.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also other religions that are faithful in their beliefs, and they sincerely hold these things, but there's a lot of them. There's a lot of different ones. And the question from the consumer point is, well, which ones do I believe, and how freely and fairly can I make this exchange? And this starts getting into some really interesting sociological things. The first thing, and I go back in sociology, and we talked about this before the podcast a little bit, and I thought your insight here was absolutely brilliant, is that sociology of religion basically tells us that people pick their religious denomination to engage in a trade with a church based upon the fact that they were raised in that church,
mm-hmm.
that their parents went there, or at least when they were born, their parents started going there and said, kid, these are the values, these are the ideas, these are the virtues that we want you to absorb here. The question is, how much of a voluntary exchange is that? This gets into a very interesting thing, because you're dealing with somebody, a person who is just born, who's 2 years old, who is 5 years old, who is 10 years old, And as the Bellamy brothers used to sing, how they got drugged. They got drugged to church every Sunday. More or less against their will. A teenager doesn't want to go to church, and I can do it, I want to sleep in, or do a lot of other things. So you're being put into this environment of an exchange, possibly against your will. And that issue of coercion comes in. And that's kind of interesting. So how would a you voluntary exchange theorist deal with that issue of young children who, you know, by most contemporary standards or casual reasoning say, well, you know, these kids can't really make good choices, so they need to be guided or nudged into a certain direction.
Right. That's a question that I don't think necessarily has a subtle answer. I mean, different organizations have different answers to this. You can think of the idea of kids being introduced to religion as a way of reducing search costs. Mm-hmm. So it's expensive and difficult and time-consuming to go out and find a, you know, which set of community ideals appeal to me free of context. You know, if I were an ideal human form existing in the void and I were out looking for the correct, proper religion to find, well, that would be difficult and expensive to do. Luckily, human beings don't live in context-free environments. We live in the networks that we were born into and with the family and friends that we've got and the communities that we live in.
And so is that taken as a given in you voluntary exchange? Because we talk about the BATNA and the coercion by circumstances. It's mm-hmm. a lot, you know, most of the time we can't control our circumstances just by birth. You're
right.
Born into lower class, you're born into the Hilton family, you're born into a poor country, a rich country, etc. And so that clouds things up a little bit. But so do you voluntary exchange theorists take that as a given?
What I think that, at least what I'm more concerned with, is whether or not a third party would have more information to improve the circumstances of what a particular person's relationship with God would be.
Mm-hmm.
So if my circumstance happens to be that I was born in Georgia and everyone within a 100-mile radius attends a Southern Baptist church, would somebody living in Boston be able to tell me that I should actually be going to a Presbyterian church?
Mm-hmm.
Southern Baptist churches, why, they're just awful. You can't do that.
Mm.
I think most Americans anyway, would at least acknowledge that paternalism in religious selection usually isn't a good idea. But the children angle to it throws a bit of a wrinkle in that, well, kids really don't have moral agency. So getting back to the ECC, one of the reasons listed for having a voidable contract is that one of the parties to the contract is under the age of 18.
Mm-hmm.
So the several United States will not enforce a contract with somebody who has not yet reached majority age. Well, why is it then that we're comfortable baptizing children? Why isn't the relationship with God allegedly supposed to be, you know, a personal realization of that covenant?
Yeah, and there's a lot of religions and a lot of religious debate over when someone should be baptized.
Mm-hmm.
I was baptized into the Catholic Church,
mm-hmm.
and I can't even remember it. I was a very, very, very young toddler or young infant when this occurred. And so, yeah, that becomes a problem. Whereas other religions say, no, you have to have complete moral agency in making that decision,
mm-hmm.
and will only accept adult baptism.
Precisely,
and,
yeah.
You know, the Baptist being a good example of this, and so that becomes an issue there. But again, I'm interested in this issue of moral agency and children,
mm-hmm.
and it's not just religion. I mean, you think about this and put this in the context of any type of exchange relationship. You know, in our family, we buy a lot of extra fruit and vegetables, and my son is going to eat fruits and vegetables because that's good for them. And if you allow the child to eat whatever they want, well, it's going to be gummy bears and chocolate chips all day, and we know that in the long term, that is not a good choice for them, so we tend to guide them in that direction, which is oftentimes I hear parents talk about, well, you know, I know religion and faith is really important, but I'm not raising my kid in any religion because I want them to have the free agency to choose things when they get older. And there's two issues that I would bring up with this in light of our conversation. One is that that's not context-free, right? What they're doing is that's an agnostic or atheist or secular type of decision for the children. Well, I'm not going to raise them in any church until they get 18, throw them out in the world and say, go ahead and pick your own. And the second, and you mentioned this earlier, and I thought this was a very, very interesting point, is the search cost.
Mm-hmm.
Right? When you're 18, your parents say, well, we haven't let you, we haven't put you in any church because we want you to decide when you're a child and stuff like this. So go, fly, be free, find your faith in religion. And, you know, not having any experience with any of this, you go like, what? I have to take 25 courses in comparative religion or, you know, do all this church. That, you're crazy. I mean, I want to be a computer scientist. I don't got time for that. And so you are actually, because there are costs to searching, you are limiting the choices of an individual by deciding not to raise that child within a particular religious context.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's no such thing as a context-free
right
decision. So that's
and that gets to the bigger issue. So we talk here about children, but this is the area that I'm interested in, which is church-state relations and how this proceeds on in a wider aspect. And you brought this up just a minute ago too. You say, well, you have a Southern Baptist down in Georgia somewhere, and then you have a Presbyterian or Congregationalist church up in Boston. And the question is, if children can't make good decisions on what religion, and we do nudge them or push them in certain directions, we provide that context to them, could this be generalized to the societal level? And are those exchanges then you voluntary or not? I run into this discussion quite a bit with philosophers that I don't understand exactly what they're saying. We talk about religious liberty, and I'm a big proponent of religious liberty. I love liberty because it provides choices for individuals. I think this would enhance the opportunity for you voluntary exchange by widening the context,
mm-hmm.
also by limiting coercion.
Mm-hmm.
But there are others that nonetheless say, well, you can't really have true religious freedom if the religions that emerge from this freedom are false ones.
Right.
They're the lemon sellers. They're the snake oil sellers. And I'm starting to understand their perspective in light of this evoluntary exchange. The argument is, well, you know, if you allow a strange spaghetti monster religion or something like that to emerge and lure people away, and really what they're selling is just hokum and, you know, satire or whatever it might be, that's not evoluntary exchange. Right, and that's problematic. So should the state, should a central organization get involved with trying to direct people to those faiths that are not lemons, that are not snake oil type of ones? And that becomes an interesting issue here.
Well, luckily, we have a rather large wealth of historical examples of where that's actually happened. So the big pre-Reformation experience in Europe shows what happens when you tie the first and second estates together really tightly. So I should probably explain what I mean by estates.
You're talking like a French Revolution scholar.
Yes. So generally there's not like one single definition, but generally speaking, the first estate is the church, the second estate is the state, is the sovereign. And the third estate is the commoners, with the fourth estate generally being the peasants, although most people say fourth estate, and they say it to them, they think of the media. The pre-Reformation was an example of collusion between the first and second estates. So kings were all divine right. If you weren't recognized by the Vatican, you may as well kiss your crown goodbye, that sort of stuff. And that's how coercion was spread in a very, very large organizational sense across national borders and propagated throughout most of Western Central Europe. Now, you can ask Timur Kuran about this, and I talked to him very briefly once about this. The modern version of Islam, at least in the Arabic countries, is that it's all three estates colluding. They're basically the same thing. There is no distinction between secular rule, religious rule, and governance of the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
It's all done by the same sort of central authority. Well, after the Reformation, all of a sudden, the exit costs dropped. Whereas, as before, I was, if I was a peasant in 1200 rural France, I was coerced by human agency and by my circumstance to be a member of the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
I had to do it, otherwise I would risk the ire of my neighbors and the censure within the marketplace. I would have led an awfully Hobbesian life, nasty, poor, brutish, and short if I dared count myself a heretic or an apostate.
And this is not only true just in terms of the choice of adhering to a religion or that belief of conscience that goes on with inside your mind or with inside your head, which, you know, many people say, well, you can fake that a little bit, but there were actually external indicators of whether or not you belong to the church because there were church taxes you had to pay.
Yep.
And you couldn't really opt out of those. So it's not so much, well, yeah, I go to the Catholic Church, but I'm not believing anything, so I'm not really engaging in this participation. But when the tax collector came around mm-hmm. and say, it's time to tithe, and you decide not to put any coins in the bucket, you got a problem there. And you are coerced to not necessarily belonging in terms of the mental way to the church, because, again, you can mentally opt out and just say, I don't believe, but I'll show up.
Mm-hmm.
But you are actually being coerced to support an organization that you don't agree with. It's almost as if I was asked to be forced to buy candy bars or automobiles or healthcare.
Back then, it was like buying a Ford. Mm-hmm. You could get a Model T, and you could have your choice of color of black or black.
And everyone had to get one.
Everyone had to buy a car. And then along comes
Martin Luther and
Luther and the entire Reformation, and all of a sudden we have Chryslers and Toyotas, and So the apostasy that happened after the Reformation was group apostasy. It wasn't like a single. You're still individual human is still bound within the networks that they're embedded in. I still have my neighbors. I still have all my friends. I still have all my family. So the costs of shunning them and going off and doing my own thing are still pretty high. But the entire group as a whole could say, okay, well, we're not going to pay anything more to Rome. Now we're going to follow this Luther guy, or we're going to follow this Calvin guy, or we're going to go do our own thing. And
this actually does lead to the fissipariousness of religion. This is one of my mm-hmm. favorite words or terms that my colleague and friend Steve Pfaff gave to me, but fissiparious nature, in that, yeah, there was group membership going in different directions, but as this has evolved, and as you look at the history of Protestantism, there's divisions and sects within, you know, Lutheran and Calvinists, and they divide into all different sorts of areas that allow for greater consumer choice, that allow for exit, that reduce the ability of any one religious organization to actually coerce an individual into it. It changes the circumstance, I believe.
And the amazing thing about it, to me anyway, is that it provides for whole new organizational schemes.
Right.
So, Barry Weingast has a glorious 1996 paper about the nature of market-preserving federalism.
Mm-hmm.
So he takes this idea of multiple governments operating over the same people and the same territory and expands, adds a few new criteria into it to say that, well, look, you need to have hard budget constraints on the local government, you need to have authority over business regulations at the local government, da 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 da. So he has these additional constraints in order to make federalism to be market preserving. Well, you can apply that same very idea to virtue preservation, I think, in the context of religion. What organizational forms of a large religious movement will preserve the exercise of virtue among the congregants? And I think some organizational forms do well and others don't. So when you have a central church authority who believes that it's in the interest of the church to dictate the small minutiae of how people find their virtue and exercise a good life, that doesn't appear to me to be virtue preserving. Okay, so let's talk for just a minute what I mean by virtue. When I'm talking about virtue, I'm talking about the four classical virtues and the three so-called Christian virtues. The four classical virtues come from Aristotle. They actually have an older pedigree than that, but Aristotle was the one who first described them. They are justice, courage, temperance, and prudence. So two of them, the temperance and the courage, these are sort of concrete. When I have courage, I know exactly what I'm facing. The other two, ditto for temperance, you know, I judge the coffee before me. Should I have a second coffee? Should I not? What would be the temperate thing to do? For justice and prudence, these are abstract, sort of distant notions. Justice tends to be very abstract. But still, justice and prudence are still contained within that small sort of neighbor-friend kind of relationship. You can think about congregations, typically not much more than, you know, 100 people, which is about the right number that everyone still knows everyone's first name and they can recognize other people's kids or whatever. When you start talking about tens of thousands of people, well, no one person can know the intimate details of the lives of 10,000 people. So how can a leader of a huge congregation like that really get into the nitty-gritty of the nature of the decisions that other people are making? It becomes very difficult to second-guess the internal virtue calculus when you're dealing with such a large group.
This is a fascinating discussion, one that I see the connections between what we would call the secular marketplace and what I termed and what others have termed the religious marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a hard concept actually for a lot of people to understand, and I'm using religion here might help both sides or both entities kind of understand this, because as you're talking about the preservation of virtue in a very large organization with tens of thousands, if not millions or a billion people, if virtue is defined and enforced from a central hierarchy, from a certain specific leader or a small group of people over the entire community, that it can create a lot of individuals or a lot of difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
And virtue could be lost, especially if the person who is leading this congregation, this denomination, is not virtuous in and of itself. The more you concentrate power in a certain people, the more you have to rely upon the virtue of that individual, whereas if you have a more decentralized type of organization, the top can corrode a little bit, but as long as the grassroots are preserved, you preserve virtue.
Exactly. Within an individual congregation, the congregants have the right of exit. So if I don't like my pastor, I can go to the next town over and find
a different pastor, a different denomination.
If I don't like my bishop or if I don't like my pope, it becomes a lot harder to vote with my feet.
Especially if the first and second state are aligned with one another, making Catholicism the only option available.
That's why this idea of maintaining the actual exercise of the practical virtue itself has to stay, must stay local in order to be virtue preserving. Because the more you centralize the actual details of shepherding a flock, and the farther and more distant that becomes, the more you run into these fragility problems, and the whole thing can break, and nobody's happy.
As you were talking about this, I was thinking about this in the secular marketplace too, and I have a number of students who often tell me about how giant corporations, megacorp, are faceless and they don't care about individuals. It's the same kind of thing as with a religious hierarchy. I oftentimes tell them though that if you have franchises, if you decentralize your organization, the local manager of the Dairy Queen has a strong incentive to preserve virtue, so to speak. And this goes back to Adam Smith, is that they might not necessarily be virtuous, but the form of organization forces virtue on them, because you have to be a good business person. You have to please the customer in many respects in order to get repeat business. And so that works out very well. And in the context of religion, it's the same kind of issue here, to the extent that either you have lots of religious competition, and some of them might be snake oil, you know, lemon automobile sellers, and there might be some regret on some individuals, but those people, I think, get weeded out fairly quickly, because I think people are relatively smart at figuring these things out. You can't necessarily fake it for a long period of time, maybe in a couple of years or so, but people can be flushed out of the bushes, I think, who are doing that kind of thing, to the extent that there's some competition here, or also to the extent that the organization allows for this kind of competition to occur via this, you know, market-preserving federalism, to use Weingast's terms. I mean, that's one of the things that I'm fascinated in learning about and researching is this issue of subsidiarity within Catholicism.
Yeah.
Is taking the authority of the church to its lowest possible level. It's a very Protestant idea, or I should say maybe Protestantism is a very Catholic idea couched in subsidiarity here, but it's one of those neat things that it mitigates in the U-voluntary exchange criteria. It mitigates that issue of coercion.
Right, and the coercion really is the sort of name of the game. If you're going to assume that people have autonomy over their lives, then they should have, if you assume that people have autonomy over their decisions about who to marry, about who to spend their time with, about what products they want to buy, of course they should have autonomy about what faith they subscribe to.
Mm-hmm.
And in the instances where a church itself may be, so Jonestown is the counterexample of what we're talking about. Jonestown was a quasi-religious organization that obviously used clear, direct coercion.
Mm-hmm.
That is not even voluntary, let alone involuntary.
Mm-hmm.
So they're the entire spectrum that covers individual one-off, you know, can I buy a new pair of shoelaces, sort of involuntary market exchange, all the way to your money or your life,
mm-hmm.
that same spectrum applies in faith-based areas too. So when we do have instances of direct coercion, we have religious leaders who are bullying their congregation, that is an instance that should fall within the jurisdiction of law enforcement. We don't want private coercion occurring.
That's interesting. And so I want to raise this issue in terms of, should we get the state, the second estate, to start to regulate the first estate in deciding which religions are valid and which religions are selling snake oil and lemons. That you bring up the Jonestown issue, and that was definitely clearly coercion. He takes his congregation, there's psychological manipulation, he moves them to a completely different territory, so it just really limits the possibility of any kind of exit. And he was also trying to escape other things from the government trying to regulate him as well.
Yeah.
And it's certainly a bad situation. And, you know, one of the things I always have to remember is that we can't have the perfect society that everything always is. There's always going to be bad things like this because mm-hmm. there's always going to be bad people, or to put it in terms of religion, there's always going to be sinners. But then to what extent do we give the state the power to determine which religions are too coercive, which religions are selling the snake oil, or as we talked about at the beginning of this podcast, that issue of ex post regret. I mean, does the state need to protect us from faiths that we might regret in the long run? You know, some people in Germany says, well, we're not going to allow Scientology as an official religion because, you know, we've looked at this and people, they're going to regret it after a while. And so we need to protect them from that. It's an issue that I struggle with in terms of religious liberty, and it goes back to some of those people saying, well, you can only have true religious liberty if you eliminate the false religions, because, again, you know, by your criteria of the U-voluntary exchange, there's going to be ex post regret, there might be some coercion, there might be coercion by circumstance. What are your thoughts on that? Because I tend to be very liberty-leaning in allowing churches like Scientology or other faiths that, you know, spaghetti monster faiths or snake oil faiths or whatever they might be, to exist, because, you know, in large part, I don't know myself which might be the true religion, and I'm certainly less willing to give a central hierarchy in a state apparatus that ability. What are your thoughts on this?
The von Mises Hayek knowledge problem is incredibly salient here.
Yeah.
This is the place where Austrian economics gets a chance to shine. Because when you're dealing with a religious organization, there necessarily needs to be coercion. The idea is that we're taming the Hobbesian beast that dwells within us all.
Mm-hmm.
So the voluntary part of the voluntary coercion is that I agree in advance to
have my baser instincts curbed by this organization. I opt into this. After that agreement is made, then there has to be some sort of mild, you know, if the person starts out fairly virtuous, then it'll be almost nothing. But if the person starts out a little on the rotten side, then from an outside perspective, the organization is going to look like it's coercing this particular person. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult. There's the epistemological problem there is humongous when you're a third-party observer. All you can do is look at outcomes and look at what people say. Well, talk is cheap, and it's very difficult to judge a process strictly by its outcome. You need to look at what the original product is, what the treatment is, and then what the product is. And mm-hmm. You can't necessarily rely on people's cheap talk about, oh, I regretted that particular mistake. Wow. Did you really regret it, or are you just saying you regret it?
Yeah.
Or are you suffering from some cognitive illusion where the regret ends up being just accidental?
Hmm.
So it's very difficult for people to second guess what the promises of salvation are. And it's even more difficult for somebody to do that on somebody else's behalf. So I tend to fall on the side of religious liberty. But again, there is a spectrum there. And I mm-hmm. think that awful things like Jonestown, that was I don't know if it was a preventable tragedy. Certainly after it occurred, it seems as if we want to say that somebody should have stepped in and put a stop to it. But as it was progressing, can necessarily have made the call at the time that would have happened. We see the outcomes, but hindsight is 20/20.
I guess they get back to that issue of virtue-preserving federalism. Mm-hmm. To what extent could the local community have done something to do it? Because one of the things that I see in the history of government is that when you do have a Jonestown like that, somebody does say, well, we should have seen this, we should have prevented this, and then all of a sudden a new set of rules and regulations are slapped up. Everybody says, oh, these are fairly reasonable, it's preventing ex post regret, but then those are used to really clamp down on the opportunity to allow other new religions to flourish. That might be actually virtue enhancing. That might be better than others. So it's an ongoing problem of how you tame that beast.
Well, it's sort of, I mean, it's possible that it could be virtue enhancing. The concern I have with that, though, is that it really saps the ability of the local community to monitor and enforce what's going on within it.
Exactly.
You say that, well, some bureaucrats across the Potomac, mm-hmm. oh, we are recording this in Fairfax County, by the way, for mm-hmm. our listeners. So D.C. is very close, and the folks who work there don't have the necessary local contextual information to second-guess other people's religious choices. They just don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't. There's no amount of technology that exists or is likely to exist anytime soon will allow you to peer inside somebody else's soul and find out what it is that is driving their particular decisions to associate. Now, if the context is richer and local communities would have, like, where did Jonestown start out? I want to say it was the Bay Area.
Yeah, San Francisco.
San Francisco, yeah. So if the local neighborhoods there felt more empowered to sort of see what was going on, is it possible they could put a stop to it? I can't say for sure. But it seems more likely that they would have had an ability to kind of shut that operation down if there wasn't this idea that responsibility for community norm enforcement and law enforcement belonged in the hands of distant specialists.
Yeah, and I think I have to make a methodology point here, too, in terms we focus on Jonestown as a critical exception, and we don't see a lot of the places where the local community steps in and breaks up a small church mm-hmm. and dissipates it, because those just fall off the radar. They're very difficult to measure. You only see the examples of the house on fire. You don't really see the ones that don't catch on fire. I mean, they're there, but you don't pay much attention to them.
Mm-hmm.
And in a world that has billions and billions of people, there's always going to be wacky situations. I'm always concerned about restricting the relationship of trade and exchange based upon a few extreme circumstances rather than the general issue here. So
mm-hmm.
a lot of stuff to think about here. I love the U-Voluntary framework as a way of thinking about these issues and the specific six categories that you have given me to, you know, especially the absence of ex post regret, absence of coercion, physical coercion, as well as coercion by circumstance, as a way of really kind of understanding religion and church-state relations.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, and when Mike first started inviting me to blog there, I didn't even consider religion to be something that the framework would naturally lend itself to. It's only since I've been listening to your podcast that I really even gave it some thought. So this is, I think this is an excellent opportunity to put things together.
A lot more research to be done, a lot more thinking to do, and I want to thank you for letting me on your podcast.
And thank you for letting me on yours.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.